Well, this time there's a reward for listening to me. If you get 40 more minutes and you get lunch for it, so. Okay, let's move on to the EMI-EMC requirement. Basically, like I said earlier, this requirement was the answer to Tempest, and a bad answer. It makes a certain amount of sense that certainly if you're selling this equipment that it should meet FCC standards and not radiate so much that it's almost considered a hazard to have in your environment. The purpose was, and there has been enough side channel work certainly recently, that you can understand that if your box radiated sufficient RF energy, doing a side channel analysis would not be that difficult. So that was the original intent for having the EMI-EMC requirement. And basically, at levels 1 and 2, you have to have an FCC Class A certificate, which is the commercial one, which allows a little more leakage. And for levels 3 and 4, because they want to make them even a little tighter, you have to have the B level certificate that is allowed for use in private homes, which is a somewhat more stringent requirement. It's usually not difficult. If you're doing a level 1 module, you usually just, take the box that you're doing the test on, put it on top of the copy machine, punch the button, there's a little FCC sticker on, you get the picture of the FCC sticker in your lab will usually take. Obviously, what you do want to do is make sure you get the FCC type certificate. You can probably, usually the computer is going to have that in the documentation. The traceability can be a bit of a pain. If you're doing your own product, be really careful. There are a lot of counterfeit FCC labs. When I was working at the test lab, we had that happen more than once. Somebody would send us the certificate. It is part of the lab's requirement to NIST that we have to validate the certificate. So you go look up the certificate number or the vendor's certification number, and you find out that the lab isn't really an FCC accredited laboratory. And then then as a lab person, I have the really uncomfortable job of going back to the customer and saying, I'm really sorry, but the FCC lab you used was counterfeit. You have to go do the test again. And no one has ever thanked me for that. So what I do, hopefully now that may earn your thanks, is make sure your lab's real if you actually have to get your own stuff tested. Also, the other thing is, and I've had this happen, where the actual indicator for the test, they don't always put they don't always put 47 part 15 class A or B on the test. They're going to put a test identifier number, which you then have to look up and send that along with the certificate to the lab, so the lab can the link to that on the FCC site. I've had that happen just as recently, where it did not use the standard most common term at all on the certificate, and I had to go find the reference. So that's also something you have to be aware of. Okay, self-tests. For those of you who have not done a FIPS 140 module before, you've never seen this. And you better know it really well by the time you submit your module. Power-up self-tests are required that you do known answer tests for all of your approved functions before the module is allowed to enter the operational state. Now, so that means you have to, for example, AES, you have to do an encryption, a known answer, and a decryption known answer. One little hint, round trips are not permitted. You can't just say, okay, encrypt this chunk of data, decrypt the result, and I got back what I started with, I'm good. No, you're not. You have no idea what was performed. All you know is that you performed some reversible action on your data. You don't know that you really did AES. So each of the power on self tests have to be performed as one way. So you do an AES encrypt known answer test and an AES decrypt known answer test. All of the symmetrical algorithms must be done separately. You have to make sure each operation is tested, no round trips. And so remember that. Again, that's one of those things that's in the implementation guidance that's not clearly spelled out in the standard. So that is something that you need to take account for. Also, the integrity test can be a bear, because you have to make sure that your entire module is checked to make sure that it hasn't changed since the last time you looked at it. Now, there are a lot of ways of doing this. There are a lot of ways that are very difficult, especially when you're reading a file off a disk. I suggest for those of you doing level one modules, go look at some open source code and see how it was done, because that's generally the best way to look at an example. It's kind of just a sticky thing to get right. So you getting a little help on it is not wrong. Make it easy on yourself. Conditional tests are performed when a particular operation is invoked that requires it. And those are usually key pair type of verifications. There's also a continuous test on, again, back to the random number generator. Every time you draw a new number out of your random number generator or your entropy source, both of these require this continuous test, you compare it to the last draw. And if they match, you might have a problem. Now, as it turns out, a lot of people just pull that one. If they match, they call it a failure. It's birthday math. You're going to have a lot of failures. Trust me. If you have any significant number of modules in the field and you're even pulling 32 bits twice and comparing it, you're going to have a lot of failures. Go for a third as a tiebreaker. And I know this from personal experience, because when we finally figured it out and did it, calculated it as birthday math, it turns out that we had the exact number of field failures that the arithmetic would have predicted. So that's one thing on the continuous test. It's easy to accidentally fail it. So any place I've ever been, we always set it up to where if you do get a failure, you pull a third time. If all three match, it's definitely dead. By the third time, though, chances are it won't. So, and it meets requirements. We've never had anyone complain about it in the FIPS process, but it certainly saved us a lot of field failures in places I've been at previously. If the module fails the self-test, the module has to go into the error state, announce in status that it's dead, and not perform any operations, except to say that the status report that it's dead. In 197.90, they're probably going to allow lazy testing. So the thing is that you can put out, you only, like right now, you have to do all the known answer power-up self-tests before the module can enter an operational state. And if any one function fails, you have to stop the module. 197.90 should allow that, for example, some tests that take a long time, let's say your RSA tests, you can already, as soon as you pass your AES test, you can use AES and then do the RSA test before you use RSA. And the same thing if your random number generator fails, you just can't generate keys, but you can still do AES if your AES passed the test. Those sort of things, you got to be aware of that.
How do you do AES without random IVs?
If you have the IV stored, if it was a continuing operation, that sort of thing. I mean, yeah, you can do any operation that does not require a new random number. Sorry, I should have.
That would make more sense.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Good catch.
Two questions. One is from a lab perspective, evidence. How do they prove the self-tests?
Okay, you have.
And then the second part is in and out of bypass mode. Can you elaborate on that?
Okay. To prove that you actually do the self-tests correctly, you have to be able to make every one of them fail during the lab testing. Yeah, thank you. This is a good. This is something that is a bit painful. Some companies have gone to the point where they now build the failure mechanism into the test and use a flag or a environment variable to trigger the failure. Some actually still go in and make special versions of their code that are hacked to make each test fail and then give the lab all those versions. Either way can be used to pass the test, but the important part is you have to show that each one of your power on self-tests can be made to fail and that the module correctly enters the error state. So that's something you, again, have to work with your lab on, have to work with your developers on, have to prepare for. If you're, it's one of the things that you won't have done if you haven't done FIPS before. Bypass. Okay, bypass needs to have two independent actions to enter bypass. And so your test has to be able to show that triggering either one of those will not allow you to enter bypass. Triggering both of them will, and turning them off guarantees you can't go into, you can't do bypass. And so, but it's always required two separate actions to enter bypass mode so that, it, you know, basically it's no single point of failure kind of thing. So I think when I did that when I was a developer, we would have two separate registers, each with a bit that would be, so you'd have to do two separate write operations to put something into bypass. That's going to be up to your lab. I mean, the thing is, it was always done in hardware in the stuff I did, and we never had a problem with that. But I mean, if you do it in software, yeah, I guess it'll be up to your lab to do the code review and decide whether that's all sufficient. There's no absolute on some of this, except for the fact that you got to prove that it turns on and turns off correctly. There's no absolute given mechanism you have to. Well, but the thing is, there's a certain amount you have to prove, and then, okay, it's accepted. That's the way it's always been as far as I've known. Okay, design assurance, and this is basically just best practices stuff. You have to have configuration management. Now, most people use some sort of source code and version control system, but technically, you do it on a yellow legal pad and keep it accurate, that meets the requirement. I mean, I don't know that that's possible with the complexity of a lot of stuff people do anymore, but the important part is that you do have a configuration management system that is kept up and correct in place and the lab verifies it. Delivery and operation. You know, you have to do some operation to make sure that the module gets delivered to the customer in its unmodified form. That may be, you know, with tape seals on the box and shipping it through the U.S. Postal System. That meets requirements in many cases. You know, it may be much more complicated than that. It has to be based on the level and based on your mechanism for delivery and operation is. Your development, again, do you use best practices? Do you have coding rules in place? You know, coding standards, stuff like that. This is not to the level it is in Common Criteria, but the lab's going to have to look into this. And of course, lastly, guidance documents. The security policy will cover most of it. But basically, the lab needs to ensure you have enough documentation in place that both the administrator and the user can correctly configure and use the module in the approved mode of operation and use it correctly. Okay, mitigation. This is the one I talked about before. That is the optional section. And like I said, timing attack is probably the easiest one to describe. If you have, you know, blinding in your RSA so that you can't do a timing attack on it, you can get credit for it. If you do things to avoid power analysis, whether it's shielding or, you know, you went over and to Paul Kotcher's company and bought their code, you can claim all that stuff. But the point is, the lab has to verify it that they actually witnessed that you do these things, or they have to put a disclaimer in the security policy saying it's been unverified, which basically means you're claiming it, but there's no proof. The lab is supposed to verify it.
Only publicly available data. Verify only from any publicly available data.
Well, I mean, this, yeah, they're publicly available. I mean, if you're doing something like RSA blinding and you're using a method that's well known and you reference it, that's sufficient because they verified it in the code review. Okay. We actually, Beverly, do you have any statement on this? Sorry, okay. All right, it's okay. Okay. Here's a question, and you tell me if you want to make any statement about it. They've asked for mitigation of other attacks. The statement is that if the vendor produces a statement saying how they, a sound statement of how they mitigate an attack, that's all that's necessary. And I was saying that it needs to be verified by the lab. Right, and the lab has to make.
But the lab does not have to verify the mitigation mechanism, though, right? It's just a statement saying, well, how they mitigate against a specific attack, but it's not a testable feature. It's testable.
Right. I don't even have to verify the new implementation. I don't have to verify whether it's in the code. So I just look at this statement. If it says I painted the module green to prevent EPA, I will say that's unreasonable. If they say,
So vendor affirmation, because
promise time you go through the requirements. Section 11 says that what I'm tester is verifying that it's listed in the security policy, and then there's IG 14.2 that says the level of detail in security policy should be equivalent to product policies. So that's the level of detail they're required to give me. So I can't do much with that.
On the other hand, it's if the vendor has implemented something like this, then he shall put it in this section.
Right.
So it's not allowed to have a SPA, DPA countermeasure and not stating it in a security policy. So any kind of security mechanism that is intended to mitigate one of these other attacks shall be listed in the security policy.
Okay. This is one of those interesting ones because both as a vendor and as a lab, some level of verification was always performed. Okay, I'm corrected. Sir. If it's going in a non-FIPS mode, it's completely out of scope. So it's only thing that counts is if it's in approved mode.
Yeah, but would this know if the self-test indicator don't mitigate this other attack anymore, everything else works fine?
Ooh, interesting. The self-test, that's interesting because the self-test wouldn't be required to verify that. That's, I would have no idea how to answer that because the self-test to check your mitigation would not be required. So it would not be in the required self-test list. So if it failed it, how you have to respond to it, I think would be up to you. Okay, the testing process. So now that we've gotten through here, we've got a module that we think is good. What's the process for testing? Okay, we go against the DTR. And the derived test requirements were taken directly from FIPSON 40-2, and the whole purpose is to offer a repeatable and testable basis for conformance. So that's the whole point. It's repeatable, test for conformance. And that's the whole point of what your lab's doing. So theoretically, if you gave the same module and all the collection of stuff that goes with it to any one of the 22, 23 labs these days. Count always goes up and down a little. 23. If you gave that module to any one of the 23 labs, it would pass or not pass for the same reasons at any of them. And it's probably pretty close to that. So the thing is, that's the whole point of the DTR. So let's talk about how to read the DTR, because that's really one of the most important parts. I'm not going to go into the individual test mechanisms, because that varies too much for every module. But what I'm going to talk about is how you know how the testing is going to happen. So first of all, each entry in the DTR has at least three parts. There's the assertion, which came straight from the standard, and that's going to be the requirement number and the assertion sequence number. So for example, AS0103 is applicable at all four levels, and the operator should be able to determine whether an approved operation mode of operation is selected. That's the assertion. That's the requirement. Then there's a set of requirements levied on the vendor, and that you have to do these to provide evidence of meeting the assertion. And so it's the same vendor VE, the same requirement number, same assertion number, but it may have a longer sequence number. So to meet AS0103, you may have to do several things. So VE0103-01 says the vendor provided security policy will provide a description of the approved mode of operation. And 02 says the vendor security policy shall provide instructions for invoking that mode. So that's how you meet the requirement, by showing you have an approved mode and showing how you invoke it. And then finally, the lab has the same TE03, so this is test requirement. The vendor shall verify that it contains a description of the approved mode of operation. So the thing is, you have to say that you have a mode, how you get in it, and now the lab has to verify it. This is just the documentation requirement. Somewhere else is going to be the requirement that they actually test to see that you entered it, that the status reads right, and everything else. This is just one part of one requirement. But that's how the testing process goes. So the good part is, with the DTR and, of course, the implementation guidance in hand, you will know what is expected of you as a vendor when you build the module, and you will know as a lab tester exactly what you must look for and how you must test it and what you must provide in evidence to show that the vendor met the requirement. And that's the whole testing process. Is basically, if you took the DTR, you scratch out all the ones that aren't appropriate for your like if you're a software level one module, you scratch out everything that isn't appropriate for software level one module. Every other requirement left is one you're going to have to meet, and you will have the assertion, what you have to do, what the vendor has to do, and how the lab verifies that. And that is really FIPS 140 in a nutshell. That's the process. And so you know in advance what the lab's going to do, and you work with them to understand how they're going to do it and provide them the means so they can test it and prove that you did it correctly. And that's basically the testing process. Everything else is specific to your particular implementation, whether it's software and they've got to set something up on a particular machine, whether it's hardware and they've got to set something up on a test bench. We've had, you know, obviously a level one software module is pretty easy. When I was a lab tester, there are times I even set it up on my own workstation. There are times I had to set up a specific configuration in the lab to map to what they required. It had to be the right platform, right OS, right version. There are other times that with hardware, we may have even had to use test equipment to verify. You know, we have to hook up a scope or a logic analyzer to see if they actually entered a particular state, got to a particular place. So the testing is really mapped directly to your module, which is why you have to choose a lab that has the experience with it, or you're willing to work and train them, or they can come to you, you can set it up in your own lab and provide them enough evidence that they accept your demonstration of the test. And I've done this all these ways. Every one of them works. Which one you use is really how it's appropriate for that lab, how it's appropriate for your module, how it's appropriate for your setup. There are times we've even done part and part where We'll ship the module to the lab. They do most of the testing, but there are a couple especially messy things that may require a bench setup or something like that, where we'll actually then bring the engineer in for the lab just to witness a couple of tests. It varies, and you have to work that out with the lab based on your own module, what works the best. Okay, lastly in the testing chunk is the algorithm validation. So every place that you use an approved function, it has to be tested, and there are some that are allowed vendor affirmation, but for the most part, if all of your algorithms, all of your mechanisms are going to have, your proof functions are going to be tested for correctness by the cryptographic algorithm validation program. And so they go through a similar process, you know, that, and we'll get to that in a minute, and they prove that your algorithms are implemented correctly, and then you have a certificate for each algorithm on each platform you test. So for example, where I am now at Aruba, we use the same code on about 10 different platforms. So we have to do CAVS testing on each of those platforms. And so that's each of our certificates list all the ones that we've done. And so this is the process. It's very similar to the whole FIPS process, except this can be very quick. It might not be, because you typically have to write test harness code. The algorithms are validated independently, so each implementation of each algorithm you do on each platform has to be tested. So the thing is, if you're doing a software implementation and you use a crypto accelerator, you have to validate them both. Every time you're running a different implementation, it has to be validated. And there are tests for symmetric encryption, asymmetric hashing, method authentication, random number generation. There are even more now. The list grows every day. You can go to the CAVP website where I had the URL up here. Oops, the wrong one. Right at the URL, you can see all that stuff. All of the algorithms are done using the CAVS tool. Now understand, the tool is only for the labs. You as a vendor don't get to see it or use it. So what you do is you work out with the lab what algorithms and what modes, key lengths, all that you're going to want tested. Most labs now have a sheet that's running about 30 pages long these days to figure out all of the specific implementations. Then they take that information, they plug it into the CAVS tool, and they generate the test samples, and they zip them up and send them to you. You take the samples and you use them as input to generate the cryptographic output. You give it back to the lab, they check it, they match the certificate. Here's the rub. The format that you get the samples in is pretty arcane. It's flat text. No markings. It's really not. You have to. It takes a bit of personal time to get comfortable with all of these weird formats. If you're using a known software algorithm, pretty much all a known software library like OpenSSL, they pretty much all come with a test harness now that accepts standard CAVP input, because they all know they're going to go through it. If you're developing your own stuff, you're writing your own code, building your own hardware, you're going to have to write a test harness, or the lab can do it. The lab can do the CAVS testing, or you can do the CAVS testing. It's not trivial. You're going to have to put, especially if you're not using a well-known cryptographic library, you are going to have to invest some time in building the test harness. It's just the way it is. I do some of this testing for us now. So the thing is, I've been able to, with a set of samples and a known working test harness and the hardware and stuff configured in my office, I can run the test in about 20 minutes. Actually, I take it back. There are two tests that take about 30 minutes each to run. So it's about 20 minutes of my time, and I let it crank and grind while I'm at lunch. And so in 20 or 30 minutes of my time, I can do the entire process. But that's because we have a working test harness that probably somebody spent 3 months writing. That's the fact with calves, that you're going to have to make that investment. Yeah, there's always a little tweaking. And the thing is, it's non-trivial because you have to, certain tests, you have to recognize a Monte Carlo test because you got to do all the iterations, and they don't put all the data, the data's not in the input form. So that's one of the few times you actually take one input, crank and grind some huge number of iterations, and then one output is where a lot of the other tests, you just put in one input, get one output. So you have to be familiar and understand the tests. They're all well-defined on the CAVS website, on the CAVP website, but this is non-trivial, and it's something you're going to have to invest some time in doing. Good point. Very good point, and in fact, that's becoming an I mentioned it early this morning, and bring back to it, but especially thinking about entropy, for example, so far CAVP has been kind of giving a buy on it, or CMVP has been giving a buy on it, but like, for example, if you use the Intel RD-RAND, it doesn't put out unmodified entropy. And so technically, you cannot meet the requirement of being able to supply an entropy, of getting an stirred, whitened, folded entropy sample to do your entropy testing on. But CMVP has been accepting this for the moment. That's also one. So also the other big one is if you're doing counter mode AES, the lab reviews your counter design to make sure that you can't roll over and use the same count with the same key more than one time. And if you've done, same thing, if you're doing an FPGA or some hardware implementation where you can't get in and put the IV in, only the counter, and because the test is actually run in just plain AES mode, not even blockchaining, it's just one-time codebook mode, you have to be able to run codebook mode and not increment the counter. So the thing is, you have to be able to get to the IV input, and I've actually worked with a customer at one point who had to redo their FPGA to add those inputs. So that's something you should be aware of, that again, start with the lab, start with the test process early in your development to make sure that you don't block off one of these inputs you're gonna need access to during the testing and set yourself, because especially if it's in hardware, you're gonna set yourself way back. Right. So yeah, you have to be able to feed. Right. So again, these are things you have to remember as a vendor. Work with your lab early on, and don't forget, don't hold calves off to the end, or you're going to end up hurting yourself. Okay, so yeah. Encryption and decryption are tested separately. Counter mode, the test is performed on ECB mode, and then the counter design is examined separately. You have to be able to get to use ECB mode, and that means you have to be able to get to the IV input. You also have, and the design must show that you can only use a particular count with a key once. Now, you don't have to keep a table of the keys forever, but you have to show that, for example, the counter can't roll over and start over again and use, in that one string, use the same count more than once with a key. For GCM, obviously, there are all sorts of requirements about generation of the IV, how it's put together. There's a separate IG just on that. So if you're using AES GCM mode, look at the IG, look at the CAV site, make sure you understand how the test is performed and that you generate your IV correctly. And make sure you can access the input and output of each algorithm directly. And so he's saying, like, if you do a Wi-Fi chip, we've had problems with that. That there's no loopback mode, so you can't do certain testing. So it basically disallowed us from validating certain modes. So it's something you have to be aware of, and it may affect your hardware selection. But if you get through all this stuff, you get to put that on your box. And it opens up a whole new set of customers.
I guess just an editorial comment when you're talking about operatives. I know this is targeted for people who are new to this. We actually get tremendous value out of doing this testing, and CAPS testing has found bugs in other implementations before. Like the transition for RSA from 186-2 to -4.
Yeah. Okay, but the thing is, you have to be able to run, there are the requirements on what they test, be aware of them, and you may have to get to inputs you normally didn't think you'd have to get to. Yes, I agree, and not much. The one thing we've been able to do, and it's not universally accepted, is that if you're using CPU families, you can occasionally get multiple CPUs put on one CAVS certificate as equivalent, so you only have to do the CAVS testing on one of a family of CPUs. However, that has also been there's some disagreements at all levels on what's equivalent and what's allowed. So there's a certain amount of risk entailed there. But that's the only way I found. In common criteria, you're actually allowed to do more with equivalency, and they can test one of a family that runs the same code and claim equivalency. That's not true in FIPS. So for the most part, if you have 10 different things running the same code, you may have to test on all 10 of them. So the best thing I can say is standardizing the test harnesses and the tools and all that stuff so that the test mechanism, for example, I can put one, when I was running CAVS test now and I was trying to find, we had a bug and I'm trying to isolate it. I got it to where I could just load one tar file onto each of the platforms, untar it, type one command, go away for 20 minutes, come back, and then tar the whole mess back up, ship it back out, and I had everything I needed. So the partially is just being methodical is probably the best thing. But that means you have to have someone, either people from different platforms working together so that they agree on the tool, or people who do the tool who have to understand the different platforms. If you have everybody working independently, then you can't get any benefit. And that's probably the only thing I can really say.
And also, just from the CMVP, Chris, if you have any thoughts from the CMVP testing standpoint, not just the CAPP, but the whole testing, if we submit, are we doing multiple products at the same time, or over time, doing the same product repetitively?
I'm going to have to reiterate what Steve said. Not really, very limited, and it seems to be reduced pretty much every year or so what you can do. The scope of how you can the equivalence arguments for FIPS is really small.
Okay.
LCC, you can get away with a lot more equivalence. There's not much you can do for speeding it up or limiting.
Well, one of the statements was, oh, and if you went on the same CPU.
Well, yes. Steve touched on that. Limiting your boundary is really important. Defining your boundary as tight as you can allows you for the most reuse. And that's probably, like you're saying, that's probably the best bet for going forward if you're trying to limit the amount of free testing if you do, saving money and everything else. Using the same cryptographic module in as tight of a boundary as you can in multiple modules is probably the best way to go.
Right.
It only took a couple weeks to go through.
Right. There are two common revalidation processes. If you have a non-cryptographic relevant revalidation, so you've made changes in your module, you've changed the version number, but you haven't touched anything cryptographically relevant, you can do a change letter or what's known as a one sub, and those are really quick. But you have to, your lab has to do code diff, all that other stuff. You have to show them that you haven't changed anything cryptographically relevant. Those can be done, those you can turn those in. You have to update the security policy, new version number, and you know the lab has to do a little bit of regression, and those can be turned around in a month or two. There's the thing, the next one up, the partial revalidation, which means 30% or less of your cryptographically relevant material is changed. The lab does a partial retest. The scope of it has to be determined by the lab and then will be deemed sufficient by NIST, by CMVP during the review process. Those are, again, shorter and usually about 3 months. And then the full revalidation, if you do 30% or more in the change, is the 5-sub, the full revalidation. Yeah, we've used both ones and threes. In fact, we've got a three going on right now. So yeah, you can use all these tools and they do shorten things, but the thing is they have their own limitations. Like to get a one sub, you must have made known, zero, not any cryptographically relevant changes. And because, I mean, we're doing a three because of a change for a DRBG. There are two lines of code out of hundreds of thousands, and we have to do halves on that library and a full three sub on it. So the rules are strict, and so it's you know, zero plus to 30% is a three sub. It's still faster than a five sub, but it's still gonna take some time. Okay, questions? We have about 7 minutes before lunch. Sir. That's always the key. The choice of your crypto, like I said it, I think I said it in the first 5 minutes of the first talk this morning, and I've repeated it a dozen times. Correctly, optimally determining your crypto boundary, sometimes you have no choice. But if you do have a choice, correctly determining your boundary is probably the single most important decision you make.
What are the considerations with that?
Hmm? making it as small as possible.
Okay.
But you have to watch out, because you can't leave things outside, then you're in violation. So the thing is, you have to make sure you get, and it has to fit with, like, for example, if you're going for a level two, you're kind of stuck. Now, you can still control your algorithm boundary, but not your crypto boundary, not the rest of it, not your module boundary.
Okay.